You know, each of us, I think in many ways, oftentimes in life, as we walk through life, there are certain things that end up defining us or end up shaping us. And then there are certain things that we just know in our life journey that are deep passions of ours or realities of ours that we just know kind of define who we are. It's that thing that you know at the end of the day, you will always, always, always go back to that because that's part of your core. It's part of who you are. It's certain loves we have and certain things we do. I think about this stuff fairly often. Like I wonder oftentimes in my own life, if I get into certain circumstances, I wonder what I will do in those circumstances because I recognize in those moments I will be defined in some ways. Like for instance, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but I've often thought about this. I'm standing on the edge of a bridge in the winter up north and the river is frozen over. And a plane comes over my head and crashes into the river. And people are getting out of the plane into the frozen river and they are struggling to swim to the edge. What do I do? Do I jump in the river and start rescuing people at the cost of potentially my own life? Or do I stand on the edge of the bridge watching the scene unfold and experiencing it from there? I mean, do you know what you would do? See, I don't know what I would do. I know what I want to think I would do, but until you're standing on that bridge, you really don't know. You're on the highway and there's an accident and there's flames everywhere. Do you run into the burning flames to drag people from the car or do you stand by and watch as it happens? I'm not talking right or wrong here. I'm just talking about moments that ultimately at the end of them, when they're finished and they're done, they sort of speak to the deeper parts of what our natural core tends to run us to, right? So for me, I have certain things like that. Like for instance, if I think about the burning car scenario and I go, okay, now put my kids in the car. Finished. Story finished, right? I'm running into the flames. I'm going. It's done. I don't have to think about that. If I put my kids in the river, I'm in the river. If I put my kids on the beach, I'm on the beach. It doesn't really matter. Why? Because for most of us, certainly if you put family members in those scenarios, it's a big deal. But for me, I know at my core, this is a defining factor because as long as I have been on this planet, I have known that deep down, I was made to be a dad. That's just me. I'm not saying that's everybody. I'm just saying it's me. I love being a dad. It's probably the thing I love doing more than anything else on the planet. I choose that over other things regularly because I love being a dad. I love being a dad to my kids. I love being there for them. I love being their rescuer, their protector. I love doing all those things. And I know at my core, in my depths, if ever, at any moment, my kids are going to need me, at those moments that count, those moments that matter, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there. I'm the guy that is going to get on the plane at $10 trillion and fly in the fastest jet to get to, I mean, that's just, I just always know. That's me. That defines me. And there are many things in my life I will fail at and I will violate, but I'm not going to violate that because it is core to who I am. And then these moments unfold that really define and demonstrate that reality. We were on vacation for 3 weeks, these last 3 weeks, and on vacation, unbelievable and crazy things unfold in my life inevitably, especially since I have 8 children running around and we are at the beach. So this vacation was no exception. Early on in the vacation, we're about 4 or 5 days into the vacation, my children that have recently arrived from Ethiopia had found themselves in the ocean on a number of occasions throughout the first 2 or 3 days and had become very comfortable with the waves and the reality and the boogie boarding. And so we were kind of at what I might term normal, right? All 8 of my children can swim and they're all in the ocean and everything is relatively comfortable. So we're not in the first 2 days of panic, like what's going to happen when the first wave knocks one of them over or whatever. And so my brother-in-law, my wife's sister's husband, he arrives and he brings with him his 2 children and he's going to be there for 1 day and then he has to head out. He's a pilot. So he comes into town and it's the afternoon of the day that he's there. That morning we were at the beach. I came home. We got the kids home. I took a shower and after taking a shower, I threw on some clothes. And if you know me at all, you know that probably the thing on the planet that means the least to me, it's clothing, right? I mean, I'm the guy that's like, if there's a shirt and there's a pair of pants and I have to wear them, I'm good. And so then my wife is constantly going, you can't wear that. So my wife buys my clothes, she puts them in my closet, and she tells me which combinations to wear as I do. That's how it rolls for me. So I'm just like, whatever. So I take a shower, and I put on these new shorts that my wife bought me. They're white, and they have patterns on them. I don't know what you call those patterns, but they're patterns. And it was a shirt that went with them, and the blue of the shirt matched one of the blue patterns. And the shirt was a V-neck, and similar to this one. But for some reason, I'm not kidding, like this particular outfit, I don't know why, but I like it. I mean, I like it. I do. I don't like clothes, but I like this one. I'm like, I like these pants, and I like this shirt, and I like the way they match, and I like the way I feel in them. This is a good outfit. That never happens to me, never. But on this particular occasion, it happened. So I am in my outfit. I'm happy. I'm excited because I like my outfit. It's an unusual feeling. And as I walk out on the pool deck, my brother-in-law is heading to the beach to go surfing, and he brought his 29-foot board with him. It's not actually 29, but it certainly looked that way. Big, huge, long, white board. And he's carrying it down, and his two kids are off on the boardwalk with him. And you know those moments where you notice something that seems a little off, like four of your eight children are also on the boardwalk heading toward the ocean, and he is by himself, and he is going to be surfing, right? So I'm like, okay, there's a whole context here that perhaps he doesn't have yet because he hasn't been part of this. You know, my kids, you got to watch them. You got to do this. And there's eight of them and all that. And so I go, and then the other four kids of mine, I see them making their way through the gate already. And I'm kind of shouting, no, but it's too late because we're off to the beach. And I'm like, okay, Dan and 10 children and a surfboard on the beach. Would you do that? Like, no. So what do? I head straight down the stairs and I hit the boardwalk. And I'm coming up the boardwalk. The boardwalk runs a decent stretch to the beach, and then the beach is pretty wide. I mean, we're talking a good, decent jog to get to the actual part of the ocean. And when I hit the beach, all eight of my children have already entered the ocean. Dan has entered the ocean. His two kids have entered the ocean, and the surfboard has entered the ocean, okay? So there's the scenario I see. So I start walking at a faster pace because I'm like, just got to get to the ocean just so I can watch, just so I can kind of go, no, yes, no, no, off, yes. And then it happens, right? I see my five-year-old son. He swims across in the waves. He's pretty confident, and he clambers onto the surfboard, okay? And my brother-in-law, as any good dad would do, he gets called up on the surfboard, and he's showing him how he stands on the surfboard, and the waves are doing this. And I'm walking faster because I'm like, okay, I know what's coming next. I don't know that he does, but I do. Because within 3 seconds, two of my other boys make a beeline for the surfboard, and my 10-year-old starts clambering onto the surfboard also. So now here's Dan. There's 10 kids in the water. There's a 5-year-old on the surfboard. There's a 10-year-old climbing onto the surfboard, and there are waves, and they're coming. And I'm like, okay, not good. And then he does this, right? You do what any normal person would do at that moment. My 5-year-old standing on the board. The 10-year-old wants to get on the board. So he takes the 5-year-old, and he delivers him back into the ocean. Okay, except by this time we're this deep now instead of this deep. Now my 5-year-old can swim, but just generally delivering my 5-year-old into the pummel zone of the waves, now at this point I'm running because I'm like, I know what's going to happen. Cole's going to get knocked over by a wave. He's going to panic. I've got to be there to talk him through it. So I'm running at this point. I'm like, go, go. And my 10-year-old gets on the board, and then I see it. I see it, literally. I can't describe it to you. I'm on the beach. I'm too far to scream, but I'm close enough to see. That's the worst place you can be, right? And behind my brother-in-law, I see this swell building. If you know the ocean well, you can tell when it's a big swell. And I'm like, that doesn't look good. And I start running very fast at this point. And the swell builds fast. And when I look, I realize it is going to go over my brother-in-law, over the surfboard, over my 10-year-old. And as my 5-year-old's being delivered into the water, he is going to be caught in the death zone of that particular break. Now, he won't die, but he's in for a shock. So I'm running, and I know I've got to get to the place where I'm this deep in the water, so when he comes up from a mouthful of sand and he's going, I'm like, I'm right here, buddy, because I'm a dad, right? That's what I do. And so I'm running, and then it happens. The swell comes, and this big 29-foot surfboard, it's white, it catches the wave, and I see it do this, like that. And Mahari comes off the board, Dan goes under the wave, and as the surfboard circles its way around, all I see is a little 5-year-old going, hey. And the board comes, and I'm like, no, no, no. And I'm like, no. And I see it. The board catches him in the face. But I'm talking about like a 2x4 coming around like this. It knocks him so hard that you see his whole body fly this way. And you just see, like, you know, the movies where the teeth are flying. Like that's, I'm seeing it before me. And he goes up, he gets smashed, and he disappears under the wave. And this wave just turns white, and the board is gone, and my brother-in-law's gone, and everyone's gone. And I'm like, I'm processing. My five-year-old just got crashed in the head with a surfboard, a 2x4, hit him across the face, dropped him into the death zone of a wave and said, let's see how you do. That's what just happened. So I run as fast as I can. I finally get to the ocean just as the wave comes to its conclusion, and up comes this body part thing, and I grab an arm and a leg and I lift him up and I'm like, I've got to assess damage. I got to see. And as I pull him up out of the water, everywhere, I can't tell you, everywhere, his whole chest, just blood everywhere, right? I mean, it's down his chest, it's on his bathing suit, it's on his legs, and it's coming from his face, right? So now I'm like, I look and I see eyes, and I'm like, okay, eyes are okay. But there's so much blood from the mouth. I'm like, did it dislocate his jaw? Did it break his nose? I don't know. So I grab him and I run out of the ocean and I get to the towels because I just want to touch just to see, just to assess as quickly as I can how bad the damage is, to assess what's next. And my brother-in-law, as any good thinking person would do, runs out to me to see if Cole is okay because his surfboard just hit Cole in the mouth. And as he's standing here going, is he okay? I go, there are 9 other kids in the ocean drowning in a big wave. We can't both be here. So I go, Dan, drowning kids, go in there. And I'm like, and I'm thinking, do I leave Cole because he's not going to die and go into the water? Do I trust that the kids are okay in the water? I don't know. And this is all going on in my head, right? So I dab the cheek and I notice there's a laceration across the side of his mouth. It's not huge, but it's bleeding pretty good. It could have been a tooth that came through. I don't know. It looks like the nose is intact and the jaw is intact. So I'm like, okay, we've got a laceration that I can deal with. Let me get him to the house. So I turn to Dan and I'm going to go, you stay here, save the kids. And I grab Cole, right? And I grab him by the arm like this, right under the arm. You know where you can with a 5-year-old? Where you practically carry them, but not really. They're still running. And I look at my 5-year-old. He is bawling his eyes out. He is shocked. He's been hit in the face with a 2x4. There's blood everywhere in his mouth. He is in a devastating moment. And I look at him and I say, you've got to run, buddy. And I start running. And we run through the sand, and he's dragging, and his feet are dragging, and he's running, and he's like, ah! And blood's everywhere, and I'm running, and I'm holding his arm, and we're just running through the beach, and my mind is just on, get him to the house, because here's what I'm thinking. I've got to get another adult to the beach to rescue the other kids that Dan is trying to rescue. So I've got 2 things going on. Cole to the house, adult to the beach. That's got to happen now. So I'm running as fast as I can, and Cole is just dragging behind me, right? Can you imagine what it feels like as a 5-year-old to have a hand under your arm, bleeding from the mouth with a concussion, and someone's dragging you going, run faster! It's not a happy place. Do you know why I was dragging my 5-year-old son across the beach? Can anyone guess? Because I did not want to get blood on my nice new outfit. I remember distinctly having that thought. I do not want to get blood on the first outfit I have ever liked in my entire life. And it's white. I remember thinking, why did I wear this one today? So I grab my son and I drag him across the beach and across the boardwalk, bleeding half to death. And at least I'm arm's length away so that all the flowing blood doesn't get on my nice new pants. That doesn't sound like a big deal. It's a funny story. And most of you can go, yeah, I've had an outfit like that. Maybe not. But it was a huge deal to me. It was a huge deal to me. As a matter of fact, the first time I have cried in many years, just really just cried, was that night. Because I lay on my bed and I thought to myself, what happened in my heart? That in the moment when my 5-year-old son, more than probably in a very long time, needed me to pick him up and hold him close and run with him in my arms so that he felt the embrace of his father and knew that he was safe and that he was okay and that everything was going to be fine after he got hit in the mouth by a 2x4 in the middle of a rough ocean. The moment he needed that from me, my immediate reaction was to sacrifice that moment so that I could rescue the washing of a pair of white pants. Of all the things that could have stolen me from my child in that moment, of all the things on the planet, how could it be clothes? How could it be clothes? Not for me. See, not for me. That's not right. Yes, I could paint other scenarios. A big giant bear that wants to kill me keeps me from my son. But a pair of pants, this is not who I am. And I lay in my bed that night and I realized for the first time in a very long time that even the place in my life where I feel I am the strongest, where I feel I am the most centered, the most ready to be the man I need to be, in that place where I know I will not fail, in the simplest moment, I miserably failed. I violated my own core. I have followed God for well over 20 years, and I violated the very thing He has given me the greatest love for, to parent my children. I can't begin to tell you how it felt to know that I was that weak. I know for many of you, like, Renaud, it was just the clothes and the blood, but it was everything to me, everything. So I lay in that bed that night, and a question began to emerge. God, what do I do with this? I mean, if I'm capable of this, knowing you as long as I have, then is there anything I'm not capable of failing at some point when it matters? See, everything I thought I would do my whole life in that moment was called into question for me. I know it's crazy, but that's exactly what it felt like. So I lay in that bed that night and I went to sleep. The next morning I woke up and the first words that entered my mind as I came awake, the very first words were found in Galatians chapter 5, verse 1. It's a verse I've memorized many times, and so they were just available to me. And the second I opened my eyes, these words filled my mind, and it began a journey for my week that I want to travel you guys on with me. Under the chairs is a bunch of Bibles. Grab one of them if you don't have a Bible of your own. They're down there and easy to read. If you don't have a Bible at home, feel free to grab one of ours, write your name in it, and keep it for yourself. We'd love for you to have it. Galatians chapter 5 is on page 834 of our Bibles, page 834. And Galatians chapter 5, verse 1 says these words. Here they are. Ready? For freedom, Christ has set us free. Let me say that again. For freedom, Christ has set us free. That's an extraordinary statement, isn't it? He set us free for freedom. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to the yoke of slavery. What is he talking about here? What is this yoke of slavery? In Galatians chapter 5, for the rest of the chapter, he unpacks a reality that the Jewish people had lived in up to the point that Jesus arrives on the planet and fulfills and demonstrates the reality of all that God has been doing throughout time and all that he's been doing in the people of Israel. The Jewish people had functioned under the law, which its premise was this. You live a life, you know that you must be right with God, and to be right with God, there is a set of righteous requirements you must meet. And if you meet those requirements, then you're right with God, and if you don't, then you're not. And if you fail, then you must do a certain set of things in order to once again be made right with God. This was a necessary part of what God has unfolded throughout history, because if we cannot understand that there is a requirement for righteous requirements with God, we do not even know what redemption is. We can't possibly understand it. So the starting point is, you must live a certain way to be right with God. The intent was to demonstrate to us as humanity that our attempt to live that way would fail us miserably. And so Paul writes to these guys and goes, listen, you now know the full story, don't you? that your ability, my ability to live out the righteous requirements of God is not something we are able to do because we are weakened by the sinful nature. So God has redeemed us through Christ. And what did he redeem us for? Freedom. Freedom to live free of the bondage and the yoke of having to live a life constantly trying to please a God in whom we need to somehow find favor. That God loved us to such an extent that he removed from us the need to constantly feel like we must do a certain set of things to be right with him. So Paul writes and says, it is for freedom that he redeemed you. So do not live again under the yoke of slavery, which says you have messed it up. You better go make it right. And there in that bed, the first thing that God whispered to me again, as he has many times in the past, was, Renaud, when you violate your core, when you hate when you should have loved, when you are fearful when you should be courageous, when you are faithless when you should be faithful, when you doubt and you should believe, there I have already set you free. There I have already redeemed you. There I have already rescued you. And that cannot any longer violate the love I have for you and the relationship you have with me. You are free, Renaud. You are free. I know what you just did. You are still free. And then it happens. See, when you find yourself in your darkest places and you discover that in your darkest places, his freedom, the shadow of his redemption, extends past your darkest places and sets you free from them, then it suddenly becomes clearer, doesn't it? You see, God is incredibly holy and we are not so holy, right? That's how we find ourselves when we first discover the reality of God's redemption. You are lost and you need redemption because you are not right with God. We cannot be right with God. So we discover what we know is the gospel. And then the gospel tells us because Jesus died for us and became our righteousness, we are now free. And for us as Christ followers, oftentimes we discover the gospel sometime and then we move past the gospel and we keep going into spiritual maturity. And as we become better and better people, we forget the grand chasm between our depravity and God's holiness. And so the cross, the redemptive reality of Jesus, instead of expanding in our minds as we grow further down our spiritual maturity, it diminishes. We forget how bad we were and how much God had to rescue us from. But here, in these dark places, in these dark moments, when I ask God, am I still free? And God goes, yes, even from this I have redeemed you. Even when you violate your core, I have redeemed you. I suddenly look at the cross and go, is this how deep it runs, my redemption? And what was a discovery of the gospel many, many years ago for me becomes a new, fresh discovery in that moment on that day again of that same gospel. And I realized the gospel not only saved me once and for all, but it saves me every day. It redeems my brokenness every single day because it sets me free from my failure. But it doesn't stop there. As though God was like, Renaud, are you ready for the real journey now? Now that we've established that you are free in your failure, can I show you where this goes? How deep this rabbit hole runs. And then he took me to the book of Philippians. Philippians chapter 1, verse 6. Paul is writing to the church in Philippi, and he writes these words. And when Paul starts a sentence this way, take it seriously, because Paul doesn't write these kinds of words all the time. In Philippians chapter 1, verse 6, he says this. Philippians is on page 846. And I am sure of this, Paul writes. And I am sure of this. Do you hear that in his voice? I am certain. I just want you to know. I may not be certain about a lot of things, but I'm certain about this. He who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. See, what Paul is telling us here, what he's telling the church in Philippi, what he's expressing to us is that at some point in our existence, God begins a work in us. And that work, once he begins it in us, he is bringing it to completion. Do you notice there's not a single part of that sentence that has anything to do with you and I? It is him saying, I'm sure of this, that what God has begun in you, God will finish in you until the day of Jesus Christ. And so once again, I was reminded in that moment, I, Renaud, not only redeem your failure when you fail and make your failure and all of its consequence a different version of what it could have been, but I also simultaneously redeem your future so that that failure does not reoccur for the rest of your life. I am growing you, he says. When you fail, I am at work. And I will build into you the things you did not have when you failed. Were you faithless when you should have been faithful? I am building faithfulness into you. Were you fearful when you should have been courageous? I am building courage into you. Did you doubt when you should have believed? I am the author and perfecter of your faith. I will help your unbelief. Do you see what God is saying? My redemption, the shadow of the cross, which is the full expression of redemption, expands so far that it expands beyond my failure and it expands into my future. It redeems what I cannot go back and change, and it expands it into righteousness as I grow from its failure. What the enemy of God intends to bring discouragement and depression and loss and death and consequence, God uses to expand the extent of redemption in our minds to show us how big grace is. Paul writes it this way in the book of Romans, where sin increases, there also grace increases. Should you therefore sin to make grace bigger? No, you misunderstand. Whenever you recognize how deeply sinful and weak you can still be, even though you know Jesus, it only more expands the extent to which God went to rescue and redeem you. And so we sit at the foot of our failure, at the foot of the things we do badly. And instead of finding condemnation from the God who has rescued us, all we find is what Galatians chapter 5 says. I have set you free for freedom's sake. Do not fall back into the boundary of sinful slavery where you believe somehow you now must do something to redeem your failure. I have done that. There's a story in Scripture that captures the heart of this. Perhaps like others, but this particular one resonates with me in particular, partly maybe because it happens on a beach. There's a man in Scripture, one of my favorite characters. He was a crazy dude. He reminds me a lot of my five-year-old Cole. He doesn't think. He does stupid things. He has no fear. He gets himself in trouble all the time, and he should have died many times. So his name was Peter. Peter was a crazy dude. He's one of Jesus' 12 guys that followed him. And Peter, when you see Peter, everything's reactive with Peter. Everything is like immediate. If Peter suddenly feels unworthy, he jumps out of a boat and swims away. And you're like, come back. No, I'm unworthy. I know, but you know, he was always the guy that was like, done, I'm doing it. Peter was one of those guys where you said, could we please think about doing this? And where's Peter? He left to go and do that. It's just, he was just that way. And one of the things, if I sat down with Peter, if I really get the rhythms of his life right, I think if we sat down with Peter and we asked him, could you define for me if there are certain things that you know to be true of yourself? Like, I know that I'm a dad and that I will always carry my son at the cost of my pants. That didn't come out quite right, but that I know I will always do that. What is that thing in you that you say, this will never go wrong? I know this about myself to such an extent that I will not fail at this. I think Peter would have said this, at least one of these things would have been this. When everybody else deserts, I won't. When everybody else is afraid, I won't be. When everybody else is done fighting, I will not be done fighting. You see it, you hear it in Peter's voice, right? At the Last Supper, Jesus is hanging out and he says to the guys, listen, I'm going somewhere where you can't come. And what does Peter say? You know, not even you could stop me. I'm coming with you. Try to say that to God sometime. Not even you could stop me. And God goes, okay, whatever you say. Peter was the guy that in the Garden of Gethsemane, standing there, they come to arrest Jesus. This is not a good scenario. All of the disciples are standing there thinking to themselves, what do we do now? Not Peter, no. You know what Peter did? He pulled his sword. That is a very bad move when a bunch of Roman soldiers are standing there. I mean, I just want to be clear with you because I understand the culture there. By pulling his sword, you have to understand Peter knew he was going to die, okay? Because you don't pull your sword with that group of people and live. So what he was doing was he was pulling his sword and saying, if you want him, you come through me. And he knew they were going to come through him. See, Peter was not afraid. Peter was not afraid of death. He was not afraid of dying for his master, Jesus, for his rabbi. So it must have been something else. It must have been something else for him. When in a quiet place around a fireplace on the night of Jesus' trial, he is asked, do you know Jesus? And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know him. Like, I think to myself, I wonder what he was thinking. I wonder if it was like my beach, where I just grabbed my son and I just ran and I didn't think, I just did. And then after the moment happened, I kind of went to, what was that? But you see, for Peter, it didn't stop there. Just a little while later, that same night, he was asked again. And he said again, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know him. See, Peter was not afraid. So why was he doing this? And a third time, he denies the one that he knew at his core. At his core, he would never, ever miss on this. And when the rooster made its voice known, you remember what the Bible says? Peter laughed and he wept. He wept because I now know what Peter felt in a way I never have. I know what it's like in whatever way is true for you. I know what it is like when you have violated the one thing inside of you that you always knew you would never, ever lose on. It is a very dark place. And the man that Peter violated, the man that he blew it with, died that next day. Peter never had a chance to go back and say, Jesus, I am so sorry. Have you ever felt that? Where you've deeply done something wrong and you can't go back and fix it. You can't take the moment back. You can't have it back. Jesus turned out to come back from the dead, actually. He turned out to be resurrected and he showed up and met with these guys. On numerous occasions over 40 days, he spent time with them. And during that entire time, I wonder how many times Peter, when he saw Jesus with all of his joy and all of his might, I wonder if the elephant in the room wasn't perhaps lingering. Does he know? Does he know that I did this? You remember it was Peter that Jesus said, Peter, you're going to do great things for me. Remember that? I mean, when he's talking about building the church, he's like, Peter, man, you're going to be part of that crazy story. I mean, Peter knew of all the guys that was going to be on mission for Jesus, he's the one, right? All that was lost. Everything Peter thought he would have in his future was lost because when it mattered, when it counted, not even with something big like a garrison of soldiers wanting to kill you, it was with white pants for crying out loud. It was a little dumb thing that usually doesn't matter to Peter. When it mattered, there he failed his core. In John chapter 21, there is a story that unfolds that God places in here, I think, to speak to all of us and to remind us of the full extent of the shadow of his redemption, how far that redemption runs. Look at this. On page 777 of our Bibles, if you have one of those, 777, John chapter 21, verse 15. It says these words. Peter had denied Jesus three times. They're on a beach now after some pretty cool stuff had happened. Jesus is resurrected at this point, so this is the resurrected Jesus speaking, and he says this, verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Isn't that an interesting question? Have you ever asked your kids that? Hey, come here. Do you love me more than the other kids do? I'm just curious. By the way, dessert is on the table. Have you ever done that? I doubt you have, because I haven't either. It's an odd thing to do, isn't it? You know as a parent you don't do that, right? You don't go and pit your kids against each other and ask them if they love you more than the others do. So why would Jesus take Peter and call him away from the other guys and say, Peter, I have a question for you. Do you love me more than the others do? Interesting question, isn't it? Do you know what Peter believed about himself? That when everybody else left, he would still be there. When everybody else deserted, he would still stay strong. He believed that at the end of the day, when it mattered, when it was dangerous, when it was life, he would stay. And that he lost. Do you understand? He lost that. he lost the fact that he believed that he loved Jesus that much. He knew in his heart of hearts that his love for Jesus wasn't what he thought it was. So Jesus asks him, do you love me more than the others? He's asking Peter what Peter has forgotten about himself. And Peter dares to answer with love, but not fully. Look, he says, he said to him, yes, Lord, you know I love you. So he says, yes, Lord, but he doesn't say, you know I love you more than the others. He says, yes, Lord, you know I love you. So Jesus says to him, feed my lambs. What has that got to do with anything? Well, you see, the mission to which Peter was being sent on was to be this incredible force in the expansion of redemption as it unfolds through generations. And Peter thought he had lost that in this deep failure that he had had. Now Jesus says to him, I want you to know the mission hasn't changed, Pete. I know you love me. It's okay. But look what Jesus does. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? I love this sentence. Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, and here it is, catch this, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. Do you hear that? You know everything, God. There's nothing you don't know. And you know that I love you. Why did Jesus push Peter there? Where Peter finally said the third time, you of all people know everything and you know I love you. Do you hear it? Do you hear it suddenly happen inside of Peter? If God knows that Peter loves him, then Peter must know that he loves him too. See, Peter cannot define himself. Jesus has to define Peter. And Jesus in that moment says, Peter, you think you lost everything because you think that moment defines you, don't you? Reno, you think on the beach when you dragged your son that for some reason you think in that moment that has said something about you that forever will linger and call into question every other moment in your life that might happen. I want you to know something. You cannot define yourself. I know everything and I am the one that defines you. And I have already defined you as rescued, redeemed, saved. You are mine. You belong to me, and your failures are mine to redeem, and your future is mine to redeem, and I have already promised that I'm doing it. So chill out, bro. That's where he left me. He left me sitting there going, wow, I need to relax. You would think that that's where my lesson ended, but oh no, Jesus had more. One more thing. In Braveheart, there is a moment where, you know, if you've ever seen the story, the king fails Braveheart deeply, and Braveheart lifts his mask, and he sees the king, and he's devastated. And then later on in the movie, the king is with his father, and his father wants to twist his mind again. And you remember what he says? He says, I will never be found on the wrong side again. Have you ever said that about something? You do something horribly terrible, you think something horribly terrible, and you say to God, that will never happen again. We all do that, don't we? Here's the last thing Jesus laid on my heart this week. 3 weeks ago, I violated, at least in my own way, the very core of who I thought I was. I'm a father, and more than anything else, I care first about my kids. I pride myself on one other thing, and it's tied to my fatherhood. I don't lose my temper. I don't get all erratic. I don't get crazy. I do on the stage, but this is the only place. In general life, I'm pretty even-keeled, as a matter of fact. And so when my kids push every button in me and they do everything they can, I'm the guy that goes, you guys really ought not to do that. So yesterday, I've prepared this message. It's finished. I know I'm free in Christ. I know he's redeeming my failures. I know he's redeeming my future. I'm secure in the fact that just 3 weeks ago, I completely violated all that I am as a father. And so that's probably not going to happen ever again. But if it is, it's going to be a long, long time from now. And so yesterday morning, we're at home. I have 8 children. And they are just, it's one of those days. You know, I mean, there's paint on the floor, real paint, like on the tile floor, real paint. We've had this conversation how many times? I mean, and there's stuff, things, and there's, what's on the wall? Who put that there? I don't understand. And then there's the button pushing and the fighting and the clawing and the whining. I mean, it's stuff that normally happens in normal everyday life. I mean, it's not unusual. When you have 8 of them, it just happens 8 times more than ever before. And so it's happening. And then this little moment happens. And Brooke was a little overwhelmed yesterday by some stuff in the morning, so we had a conversation. It didn't go real well because empathy as a husband isn't one of my strong points. And so I was trying to fix her, and that didn't go over well. And so, you know, we had that little moment happen. And so we recovered from it, but I was still lingering in that. And then my 10-year-old son comes down, and my 8-year-old daughter comes down, and they come into the room, and my son's playing with a remote control car that's sort of the family car, but he has his own car too. And so my daughter says, "Dad, can you please tell him to give me that car and play with his car, because I want to use one too." And he does what 10-year-old boys do, because they love to tease and they love to do that. All my kids do that. And he goes, "I'm playing with this one right now." So I do what any normal dad I think would do, is I say, "It's no problem. Hopi, why don't you go upstairs and take his car and play with that?" Oh, that's changes the game. It's like the teasing ends right there, right? So it's like, put down, she can have this one. And I'm like, no, it's lesson time now. We're not changing cars. We're going to do this. And of course, he goes, "No, that's my car." And I'm like, "I know, but I'm actually the king of this house. And so everything in this house, it sort of belongs to me, actually." So so we have a brief moment of that. And he heads up the stairs to go and take the car. And I say to him as he heads up the stairs, "Don't you go up those stairs and touch that car." And I can tell it's one of those moments where the decision's already been made. And so I've got to be a little more firm. So I come around the stairs, and he's halfway up, and I say, "Don't you do that." And he turns around, and he says to me, like all my kids often do, he looks at me and he says, "That's my car." And he turns around and he starts walking up the stairs. And it was a moment for me. All the other 93 years that I have had these kids, it's what it feels like sometimes, they all came to me in that moment, and this voice came out of me. I don't know where it came from. It wasn't a good place, and it came out of me. It was very, very, very loud. And it had sort of a gargle to it, and I didn't recognize it. And I'm not being totally sarcastic. In fact, my wife said to me afterwards, "I don't know that in 16 years I have ever heard you scream like that." I just screamed two sentences. The first sentence was, "You get back here now." And as he in shock turned around and walked back around the stairs, I walked right up to him, my 10-year-old little boy. I looked him in the eye and I said, I screamed at the top of my ability, "Don't you dare ever walk away from me again." Does that sound good to you? It wasn't good. It wasn't good for him. It wasn't good for me. It wasn't good for the neighbors. It wasn't really good for anybody. It was a dark moment for me. Now think this through for a second. Run with me on this. This is fun. 3 weeks ago, I violated something I thought I would hold on to. God redeemed that, showed me freedom, showed me progress, grew me through it. And 3 weeks later, on the Saturday that I'm going to preach the message that God has given me and made real in me, I do it again. And in that moment, Jesus says to me, "Renaud, you need me every day. There's not a day you won't need me. You need the gospel every day. Yes, it has rescued us once for all. If you know Jesus as Savior, you are secure in your redemption. But the gospel also redeems us every day, as it rescues us from that which still lingers in us." And so I am reminded that I am free. I am being made freer. And I need to stay close to the gospel every day. I need to linger in the shadow of the cross, because only there am I safe. Because when I fail there, I am safe. And when I succeed there, I am safe. And so I must make sure that the gospel is mine every day. That I never see it as a past event, but I see it as an immediate need. Jesus, I need you now. Because I am minutes away from violating things I will never believe are possible. If you have ever doubted when you should have believed, ever feared when you should have had trust, ever been anxious when you should have been at peace, when you have ever been faithless when you should have been faithful, if you know Jesus as Savior, you are free even there. Even there. Fret not. Do not be discouraged, for I am with you. Listen to these words. I close with this. These came to life to me this week in a way they never have before. I've always read them one way, and suddenly they all made perfect sense to me in a whole new way. In Psalm 139, I just want you to listen. So just listen, please. Don't even read. Just listen. Psalm 139, verse 7. The author of the Psalms writes these words. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. Makes sense, doesn't it? If I make my bed in Sheol, which is Hebrew for hell. If I make my bed in hell, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. Now listen, here's where it gets awesome. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me. Have you ever felt that? You've thought something or done something and you feel it. The darkness has covered you and you are distant from God. And the light about me becomes night. Oh, I get myself there. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day. For darkness is as light with you. And there Jesus left me. Renaud, when I redeemed you, your darkness became as light to me. And you are light now. You are freedom now. You are not wrath. You are not darkness. You are not death. Live in your freedom. Live in your righteousness. Live in obedience, because obedience is now your privilege and your pleasure and your freedom, because you cannot fail even when you do. Let's pray. God, I don't know how we missed so much of your actual redemption, how we got caught up in a religion that we're supposed to try and affect a bunch of rules and regulations to keep you pleased and to have you bless us. How you became nothing but a process, I don't know. But I thank you that you are continuing to reveal through your word that you set us free because you love us, and that your love is so magnificent, so extraordinary, so transcendent, so unthinkable, that no matter how far from you we run, no matter how long we have deceived ourselves, no matter how much we have ignored, deserted, or simply hated, there is no place that the shadow of your redemption does not extend. For those here that know you as Savior God, remind them this day, as you have me, of the full extent of our freedom and the full extent of what you've rescued us from. Show us how big the cross is. And for those here that are on a journey trying to figure out what on earth life is and what on earth you are, if you even are and if you even exist, God, may this be a beginning point for them to hear that still voice inside of them saying, I love you. I love you. There is nowhere you can go that I will not find you. My love is bigger than you. May you whisper to them that you are chasing after them with your love, and you will find them. God, as we find ourselves captivated by the extent of our freedom through your redemption, make us great ambassadors of that freedom, by living it out in our lives in righteousness and by declaring it in our words through love. We love you, Jesus. Thank you for your love for us.